All right. My name is Tamara. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Tamara.
I am very honored to introduce Beverly. I've had the pleasure of walking this journey with her, and I mean, she really does the deal and is willing to go to any lengths for her sobriety. And, you know, having someone to work with like that really lights a fire. And so I just appreciate that she's lit that fire in me and continues to walk this path with me. And she has an excellent story. So, Beverly.
So, my name is Beverly. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you, everybody, for coming out tonight. So I'll just get started with where it all started. I grew up, you know, the fourth of six kids, and, you know, I did have a very loving home. It was a very disciplined home. We grew up Southern Baptist, very conservative, had a lot of religious ideas. You know, so when I grew up, there was just principles and structure and discipline, and that was that. You know, everything was a black and white world. You know, right was right, wrong was wrong. You were very instructed as to what that was exactly. You know, so for me, from my earliest memories, I was a very emotional child, you know, and I'd like to say that's changed, but, you know, it hasn't really. I remember, you know, my parents not knowing what to do with that, you know. I just felt everything, it seemed out of proportion, you know. Things were either very happy or very tragic, or, you know, I was stubborn. I wanted to do what I wanted to do, but I didn't want to get in trouble. And when I did get in trouble, it was like my earth was shattered, you know. So, like, disciplining me was just always a big event, you know, because I was very stubborn, you know. I'd get myself into those scrapes, but I didn't like the disappointment aspect of, you know, the reaction I got, you know. I just always wanted the reaction to what I wanted to do to be different in life, you know, from the very start. And I remember one time my parents, you know, they sat me down because I had written this note about, like, having all these brothers and sisters and being in this big family but feeling alone. And I had left it at, like, my piano teacher's house, and she gave it to my parents and was very concerned about this note, you know. And my parents were like, well, what were you thinking? Like, what was going on with this? And I just, like, bawled, you know. And my dad decided I must have a blood sugar issue, and, you know, and so he said I was hypoglycemic, you know, because he was hypoglycemic, and we never got any testing to confirm that, but what that told me was I get a spoonful of sugar sometimes if I'm very emotional, you know, and I get off the hook when I can't explain why I feel the way I feel, you know, and so growing up, as a kid, we were religious. It wasn't too extreme yet. You know, when I got to be a teenager, my dad became a pastor, and it just became a very, like, you live in a glass house. You know, it doesn't matter what happens at home, but when we go to church, we're the perfect family, you know. And so learning to, like, kind of deny reality or make things what they weren't, or make it sound, package it better than what it really was just kind of what you did, you know. I just thought that was normal, you know. So creating stories that sounded better or came off better to you, to the hearer, was just a way of life. Like, that was a tool, you know, that was in my toolbox. And I just remember, like, I never got with the program. I just didn't, not on the inside. It was like I sat down on the outside, but I was always standing up on the inside. You know, I did not like the whole thing, and, you know, I started kind of in my own head creating my exit plan early on. Like, what do I gotta do? And my parents weren't about, like, going to college. You know, they weren't about, it was more like you grow up and become a wife, a helpmeet, as they called it, you know, to, you know, a man of God, and that was going to be the future. And I was just like, oh my God, like, I'm in Auschwitz, you know, like, this is hell, you know, get me out, like, you know. And I just remember thinking, well, my dad likes piano, and I learned to play the piano because I got a lot of attention. Like, that was the interesting part of church. Like, I'd watch the piano player, you know, and then my parents were like, oh, look, she's watching the piano player. And I was like, oh, this gets me, like, positive attention. So, yeah, I'm interested. And then I got to do piano lessons, you know, and then my dad liked it. And then I was like, well, Dad, like, you can go to college to become a piano teacher, you know. So that was my thing. It's like, how can I get it to fit into what they want to hear, but I get what I want out of it, which is get out of here, you know? And that was just my mentality. And drinking wasn't really a big part of our life. At first, it was, like, absolutely not allowed. My mom grew up in an alcoholic family, and so we kind of grew up with ideas of what alcoholics were, and they were bad people. You know, my mom had 5 different stepdads by the time she was 10. One of them, like, shot my grandmother, like, 5 times, and, you know, waking up to broken dishes in the house, getting things repossessed, getting sent down to, like, the gas station to buy beer for the parents with money that was supposed to be for food was, like, stories I heard. That's what I heard growing up, you know, is how horrible that was. And so we didn't have alcohol growing up at first. And then when we moved to Houston and my dad became a pastor, it's like, you know, all the church ladies, like, the housewarming gifts were wine. Wine was acceptable. Like, it was, it's kind of like a Texas thing, it seemed like, because we grew up in New Mexico. And so eventually that became okay. Wine became okay. And then eventually, like, margaritas and playing dominoes or card games became okay. And that irritated me because I was like, so this is 1 year, like, something's completely unacceptable, it's a sin, and then it's not. And I was just kind of like, wait a second, you know, like, you know, but what I want is not okay, you know. So, you know, I remember my first drink. I do remember at the age of 14, you know, they'd all been playing card games and drinking margaritas, and then it was like, it was okay if I got to try some. And I can remember from the first time I had a drink, like, at first I wanted to play with them, and then I didn't want to play cards anymore. It was like, I was more thinking about, I really like that drink, you know, and how can I get more of it, you know? And then I voluntarily wanted to clean the kitchen, which wasn't a thing I did. I didn't voluntarily do chores, you know. I had to. But I voluntarily, because I was like, well, if I'm back in the kitchen and they're playing games, they'll be distracted. Like, I just already, like, from the very start was like, how am I going to get my next drink and how am I going to hide it? Because I know I shouldn't have it more than what my mom said, you know. And so I did. And also finishing off other people's drinks was just, like, logical to me. I was just like, they didn't finish that, you know, and that was like my mentality from the start, you know. And then I got really sleepy and I went upstairs and I went to bed, and that was my first drink. And I didn't always have it available, so that's like until I was like 19, like, it was really just kind of environmental controls. It wasn't available, I couldn't have it all the time. And when I got to be older and moved out of the house, that's when it became available. So I kind of started late. I was one of those that, like, started late. But I definitely, like, caught up after that. But, you know, when I was 18, you know, I remember just being as isolated as I could. Like, I had become a very resentful, angry child. And you couldn't show that because my mom, that was a challenge. Like, she loved you to show a rebellious attitude, you know, and she was gonna smash that, you know. But I wanted to be out, and I went on a mission trip with my dad because basically my dad was going, and my mom didn't want to get left home with just me. Like, not just me, but she wanted the problem child to go with him. Let's just put it that way, you know. And so I went with my dad, and I did have a very real spiritual experience for the first time. I just remember, you know, being a very depressed, very quiet, like I said, resentful person. And then on this mission trip, for whatever reason, like, I just had this moment of clarity where, you know, I knew that God was. I knew that He was real. I just felt that connection, and it was something very hard to explain, but it was like a burning bush moment for me for some reason. And I all of a sudden appreciated my parents. Like, I felt like I understood where my dad was coming from with all his talking about God and his relationship and all this. It just all of a sudden made sense. I was like, I get it, you know? And I remember, like, you know, I went home and was very different. I just got really on fire to want to help these kids, you know? One of the little boys, I think he was like 6 or 7 or something, had like a bed with just like a few belongings on it, and he really wanted to give me, you know, his little pig. And I just, that broke me, because I was like, man, I have all these things. Like, I'd never seen anyone live like that, not a bunch of kids, you know? And so we came home, and that's when my dad started his missionary work, and that was like our year of like just really trying to help, you know, these Colombians, and that became our whole life for a while. And within that year, a lot of things happened. My dad's health, we lost our home, you know, so many different tragedies happened along the way, and I got very angry. You know, it was like I felt like I got all on board, and I believed if you're like, if you're doing God's will and you're putting your all into it, that things would turn out a certain way, you know. And I just remember getting very embittered, and I remember thinking consciously, you know what, God, I tried your way, your way sucks, you know, it's a big disappointment, it's too hard, and I'm done, you know. And at that point in time, I was just like, this is good for them, but it's not something I'm about, you know. So it's kind of like an insult to injury. And when my parents lost their house, I went to live with my brother. And when I went to live with my brother, that was like the first time it was like all bets are off kind of thing, where I get to do what I want to do and no one's there to stop me, you know. And I met this guy who was 6 months out of prison. And, you know, the first, I get to live my life, you know. And he was 16 years older than me, and he was the first person that looked at me twice. Like, you know, like, I didn't grow up dating. I was homeschooled. You know, I didn't go to school. Like, every, you know, I grew up remembering feeling like I was an alien, like, very weird, and I thought it was because I was homeschooled, because my parents were religious, and I was a pastor's kid, you know. I now just realize a lot of the things of the way I was that I grew up was just, that was part of the ism, and it was alive before I ever got alcohol. And I've read that in some of the stories in the back of the big book, and I remember reading that and just being like, thank God, you know, that I can relate. So anyway, I meet this guy, and at the time, I'm not 21 yet, so that's like, he can buy me alcohol, you know. I became an isolated drinker pretty much right off the bat. I can probably count on one hand how much social drinking I did. I figured out pretty much right off the bat that I wasn't about socializing. Like, when it came to alcohol, that's what I wanted to do, and none of the rest of it interested me, you know. So I also embarrassed myself right away. I blacked out pretty quickly, and or at least right, you know, my drinking was blackout drinking. It kind of didn't progress to that. It was like kind of like that right off the bat. So, you know, it was like people were a problem, like a nuisance, and trying to figure out how to get home was a nuisance. So it's just like, let's fix this, and I'll drink at home, and that was how I drank. I do remember the first time that it was like, this is my solution. I was going to my ex's, like, his brother's house for, like, the Super Bowl or something, and I was going on and on and on about all these arguments I had in my head against my parents and why they couldn't just let me live my life and why they got to be in my business and all that. And he handed me a water bottle, which he was, like, really into working out and stuff. So I always thought, oh, he's just a healthy guy and doesn't like to share his water bottle, you know, because sometimes be like, I want to drink. And he's like, oh, no, get you some in the back, like, you know. And then he handed me a water bottle. He's like, you know what, this is going to help you. And I was like, okay. And I took a drink and didn't know it was vodka, you know. And I remember drinking, you know, like half of it, and I was just like, okay, you know. And I remember that moment where the alcohol kind of set in, and all of a sudden all that thinking just stopped. All that needing to argue in my head with my parents stopped. And I remember just like, it was like, oh, I can be right here right now, you know, with this liquor. And I remember thinking, okay, this is the solution for me. Like, it kind of was like the puzzle piece fit. Like, I just thought I was a serious, high-strung personality. And I was like, no, I was just missing this factor of, you know, drinking. And when I got to the party, I was already kind of lit, I guess you could say. And they were drinking and they were eating, and they're like, you know, have something to eat. And I was like, oh, I don't want to eat anything. Like, that was part of it too. Like, if I was drinking, I was drinking. I wasn't interested in eating. I wasn't interested in talking to you. I didn't really, you know, it was like I was drinking, you know. And I remember that same night going to the bathroom and, you know, throwing up and being sick and cleaning my face and just like, oh, I feel better now. I can keep drinking. Like, it was like a good thing. I was like, oh, throwing up's not a bad thing. It's like, get that out of the way and you can drink some more, you know. And that's just the way my mind worked from the start, you know. And, you know, so my dad didn't approve, obviously, of this guy. And it took a lot of convincing, which just meant I was stubborn and he wasn't going away, you know. And it was just one of those things where it's like, this, I get to, my choices now, you know, and the great choices I was making, you know, right? Like, I don't know. But anyway, so I lived with my brother for 6 months, and then I moved back to my parents' house, well, their apartment. And I don't remember a lot between there. I was working, going to school for a little while, and on the weekends, yeah, I was meeting up with this guy, and it was really, we were not dating, we were shacking up, you know, in Motel 6 and drinking and doing what people do when they shack up in Motel 6, you know. And and that was that, you know. And and then we eventually, you know, we get married, and that lasted all of 6 months before he got locked up again. Because he wasn't just a drinker, you know, he did other drugs and he was still living a criminal lifestyle, you know. And and I remember during that time that I was living with him, you know, my drinking really, you know, it's still kind of hit and miss right now as to how it was. It was like I went to work, I did what I had to do, and I drank, you know. And I never thought of myself as a morning drinker, but I was usually just still kind of hungover, or if I was hungover, I would take a couple shots, go to work, and it wasn't till about quitting time that I would start getting kind of shakier, feeling kind of sick to the stomach, and I knew, well, I just got to last for a certain period of time before I get home and I'm drinking again, you know. So that was just the way it was. I was a blackout drinker. I isolated, and you know, there was periods of time where I'd wake up at 3 o'clock in the morning and thinking about, I got to call somebody, and I couldn't think of anyone to call, you know. And I was, you know, there's times where I wanted to, you know, call my parents or whatever and say, you know, this is a big mistake, you know, but I couldn't do that, you know. It's like I had staked so much pride in my life. You know, it was like my life, and if I want to drink, I want to drink. You know, if I want to make nothing of myself, I want to make nothing of myself, but I'll be damned if I marry a pastor's son, you know. It was like, that's just not going to happen. And, you know, during that time, I started, you know, getting more involved with what my ex was doing, you know, and that was something I didn't want to admit to myself. You know, it was like, I would go do the things that he was doing, not really, like, I didn't do drugs or anything, but I'd be the driver, you know, and he was a robber, I guess you could say. And, you know, it was like, I mean, how, I don't know. We had storage units full of stuff that I didn't know where it came from, you know, and sometimes we'd be going to pick up this stuff that I didn't know where it came from, and I'd be the driver, you know, and mostly because I had to take over that part because, you know, he was a tweaker, and there was one time we're driving down the freeway, and they're just falling, the people are falling out, and I'm going, oh my God, and it's a stick shift, and so my mind said, I got to learn how to drive a stick shift. It didn't say, I got to quit driving with, you know, tweakers that are stealing people's stuff. It was like, I got to learn how to drive a stick shift because I got to do what I got to do. You know, and that was kind of my mentality. It was like, I'm done with the, I did not want what my parents had. I did not want that life. And I didn't want this one either, but I had to do what I had to do, you know, because drinking wasn't going to just stop, you know, and I was with this one, and that's what my life was, you know. So the whole incomprehensible demoralization was just like I had standards, and those standards just fell and fell and fell because I had to do what I had to do. You know, it wasn't that I wanted to do the wrong thing, but, you know. So after he got locked up, I already had one DWI, and then I'm trying to run all his affairs and, you know, talk to the auto theft task force and talk to, you know, show up for, you know, all of his cases and all his stuff. And then I'm also trying to manage my drinking, and I'm also trying to work, and I'm also, you know, I'm just trying to keep it all, like, in control, you know. And it wasn't working out very well, and I remember after I got my first DWI, I decided, well, liquor's the problem. You know, and I had convinced him that I could just drink just liquor because, remember, I was hypoglycemic. So the problem with my drinking wasn't the liquor, it was the mixed drinks. So get the juice out of the way, you know, and that's going to fix the problem, you know. And so that was an excuse. But I decided, well, now the liquor's the problem, so I'm going to switch to beer. You know, so I started drinking beer because I was like, that'll slow me down. I don't like carbonated drinks, and I hate beer. So if I'm only allowing myself to drink something I hate, I'll slow down. Well, then I just need to buy a lot more big cases of beer, and I didn't have a preference. It was like, which one sold the most, you know, and that was just my mentality. Like, I'm not one of those alcoholics that can tell you the brand or how much I drank or all that. It was just like, how much can I get at one time without it looking weird, you know? For the best cost, you know? And the beer, you know, that didn't work. Because one time, you know, I'm going to pick up his mail, which I had forwarded to a different address, you know? And I had started to realize that my drinking's a problem, you know? And so I'm like, I'm just going to go over there. I'm going to pick up the stuff, you know, the mail, and I'm going to leave because, you know, his friends were, you know, those shady people, you know, that were now my people, you know, and, but I wasn't one of them, you know, but anyway, it was like, I'm going to go pick up the mail, I'm not going to say anything, I'm going to leave, because I knew they were going to be drinking, they're going to be doing other stuff, and I'm just like, I'm not going to stick around, you know, and I don't know what happened, but I got there, and the next thing I know, I am drinking, and it's about midnight, and I'm realizing, oh, I had obligations to watch my ex's, like, grandma, who has Alzheimer's, and the family's out of town, and I'm supposed to be babysitting an old person. Here I am out in Cleveland, Texas, you know, drinking, you know, with people that, you know, should have warrants, you know. That's just how I'm living my life now, you know. So I head home, and I end up going into the ditch, and I only woke up because the car's like, you know, rumbling and everything, and I see a sign. I don't know what sign it is, but I overcorrect, and I think I'm hitting the brake, but I think I hit the gas, and I end up rolling my car and up in the other ditch with the car upside down. And the only thing I can remember about it is, aside from the sign, and then is, oh great, the car quit rolling, like, you know, and I'm like on the, I'm on the roof of the car, and I'm on all fours, and I'm like, okay, and I climb out of the car, and somehow a cop was there. I don't know if he was behind me or in front of me or whatever, you know, but he's already there. And I remember walking over, and I'm like, I need help, you know? And he's like, were you in that car? And I'm like, yeah. And he's like, okay, well, just sit down, and, you know, we're going to get some help, you know? And, you know, he obviously, you know, he calls for backup, and then, you know, I end up going to the ER because I kind of already knew I'm getting a second DWI. Like, I already know that. Like, I already know I'm going to jail, and I'd prefer not to go to jail right now, you know. So if I go to the ER, I'll get out of this, you know. And, you know, I go to the ER, and I just remember being handcuffed to the hospital bed. And I feel really sick, and then, you know, the cop walks in, and my friend, well, the people I was hanging out with, they called my parents, you know, and I had told them, I remember telling them over and over and over, tell them I'm okay, like, tell them I'm okay, you know, and I remember them coming in and crying, and they're all upset, and I remember just being irritated. I was like, I told you to tell them I'm okay, you know. And the cop comes over, and he tells me, and he starts reading me my rights, and I was like, and I just start crying, you know, and he's like, you know this is your fault, right? And I was like, I know, you know. And then he started going on some spiel or another, but I think he felt bad for my parents because he didn't take me to jail that night. He just said he was going to put out, you know, a warrant, and I needed to turn myself in whenever I saw that came through. I was like, oh, cool, I got out of this one, you know? And so after that, you know, I eventually got on probation, and it didn't all work out like I thought, you know? And through probation, I started going to these classes that they wanted me to go to, like repeat offender classes. And I remember they started, like, telling me about you know, families that you grow up in and different dynamics and stuff and all this and all that. And it was all really interesting. And I tried to do the straight A student type thing. Like, I had all the right answers. I filled out the paper exactly like they wanted. I kind of watched what the instructor, like, if he nodded and got excited about something someone said, I was like, okay, I need to be saying that, you know. And I was just going through the motions, trying to get out of trouble, you know, still trying to manage everything. And they sent me to AA. They gave me a paper that needed to get signed and said I need to try a few meetings to finish this class. And, you know, at this point in time, like, I was just really dead inside. Like, I remember, like, I was going through the motions and the drinking wasn't really working and I was trying to stop on my own. And I just remember getting to a place where, you know, it didn't seem to matter how much I drank. I can remember, like, I put alcohol in everything all day, and I couldn't drink enough or long enough, and I couldn't even black out anymore. It was like I wasn't blacking out. I wasn't getting super drunk. It was like I just was in a constant haze, and it sucked. And I just remember being like, this is hell. You know, I can't even escape my misery anymore. Like, you know, and I was trying to clean it up a little bit because I was back with my parents again, you know, and I just remember them always looking at me like I was just like this mental case. Like, if I came in the room, they're just like, you know, and I was just like, oh my God, I hate this. Like, you know, like, I'm not a zombie, you know. But I, you know, I look back at pictures, I'm like, oh, you know. You know, I remember planning to go to the 6:30 a.m. meeting because you know, at the time I'm riding the bus to Houston for my job, and it takes like 2 hours, and it was basically, this is what fits into my schedule, you know. And I remember going to my first meeting, and I walked in, I sat about where Randy is right now, and I was just like, I remember envisioning the night before, like, what is this going to be like? Like, do these people know they send people there? Like, you know, I was like, it's their personal meeting. Like, I'm just, like, someone on probation, I made a mistake, you know, and I just remember thinking, like, what is this going to be like? And I envisioned, like, a circle of people, like, in a literal circle, you know, because the only thing I'd ever seen was, like, Fight Club, you know, and I was just like... I was like, I just, you know, and, you know, I sat over there, and I remember, I think, if I remember correctly, Jay was leading the meeting, and he was just like, do we have any newcomers? And it was just like, you know, looks right over at me, and I was just like, oh my God, and they all looked at me, and I was like, you know, and, you know, I just thought it was horrible. I was like, they already know who I am. You know, I thought I could, like, ease in and ease out and just do my deal, you know. And, you know, and everyone shared their experience, you know, and they all started talking at me. And, you know, I really, from the very first meeting, I was one of those where it was just like, I heard what you guys were saying. And I was already crying, like, halfway through the meeting. And that's really stopped, I promise. and, you know, everyone urged me to come back, you know. And I was, and I remember, you know, Travis's aunt signed my first paper, you know. And she shared about, like, being sent here from the great state of Texas, you know, and I was just like, and that just kind of excited me, like, I mean, this sounds bad, but it did, because I was like, oh, there is someone else that, like, is a convict, you know, and that just kind of gave me comfort, because in a way, like, I mean, as much as everybody was sharing about their drinking and everything else, like, and I thought it was genuine, I was kind of scared, because I was like, they all look like they're good people, you know, like, this is scary, like, I didn't like church, and then here I come to AA, and y'all are also good people, like, geez, like, you know, and, so I started coming to meetings regularly, and it really did encourage me how much everyone, like, they ushered you to the next meeting. It really gave me a lot of courage to come to the next meeting. And I remember for me, like, the relief was at the meetings at the beginning. I didn't get a lot of relief outside. It was just, like, insanity. I couldn't sleep very well. You know, I think I, looking back, it was like I used to have these horrible dreams where I felt like I was on fire and stuff, and now I've read a little bit about DTs, and I'm like, oh, I really was DTing, you know? That's what it was, you know? I picked up smoking, you know, because I needed something to do when I was going to... especially when I was riding the bus to my job in Houston, it was like literally sitting at a bus stop. I couldn't be with myself. Like, I just could not be alone with my own thoughts. And I would just sit there and just be like, I felt like I would combust. You know, it was like at all times I just felt like, what do these people do between meetings? Like, you know, if they're not drinking, you know. And I, on probation, I had a breathalyzer. It's like I had to do it 3 times a day. And I remember plotting at first, how am I going to drink between the breathalyzer and then having a moment of clarity like they talk about, like when I was first coming to meetings, I had my first moment of clarity where it was just like, you know, you're not going to be able to drink and pass a breathalyzer like 3 times a day. It was like, that was like one of my first, like, accepting that I was an alcoholic for me, you know. I knew I had a problem, but just like really like accepting it, you know. And you know, they, especially in the morning meeting, it's like if you're gonna hang out and like share all your garbage, you're gonna get pushed to do the next thing in the steps, you know. It's like that. I just remember everyone surrounding me. I thought they were so caring, but I think at the same time they're like, "Oh my God, this girl needs to get started on the steps," you know. And so I got ushered to get a sponsor, and you know, I've heard a lot of people share about how they get sponsors. Mine, it was one of those situations where I don't know if I would ever have asked. You know, my sponsor came up to me and was like, "Here's my number if you need a sponsor," you know, just very nicely. And I was like, okay. And then I think it was like on the second or third time that I was like, I had enough courage, and I was happy that she came up and talked to me again. So I was like, yeah, I was going to, you know, I was going to ask you. No, I wasn't. But like, you know, it's like, I'm glad she did, you know. And I've heard a lot of debating about that. I'm like, I'm glad people offered, because I wasn't going to ask, you know. I don't know if I was, but that's just my story, how it happened. And I got started on the steps, you know. And step one for me, I could admit the unmanageable part. Like, I don't know, like, I felt, you know, it's not like you walk in here with this, like, great education about everything AA believes about alcoholism, you know. It was like, I was, like, blown away. I did not know AA existed. You know, I really didn't. I knew, like I said, my concept of alcoholics was that they were very bad people, and I wasn't in a place where I was able to accept that I was bad. Like, you know, I had a lot of ideas about bad people, and like with religion, there's like the chosen or the elect, there's like people God picks or whatever, and then the other ones, and I just had a lot of, you know, I had a lot of screwed up ideas about it, you know. And so, for me, like, admitting my alcoholism was, yeah, I could say I had a problem with alcohol. I felt like, is that a trick question? Like, I'm on probation for DWI, you know? so I was just kind of like, well, being truly convinced, like it says, conceding to our innermost self, like, that kind of came later, you know? But as long as I could say, yes, my life's unmanageable, you know, I was moved on to the next step, you know, and I'm grateful for that, because I feel like all the steps has, at a different time or another, kind of had a deeper meaning, or I've conceded more, you know, as the understanding has come. But at the beginning, it was just like, okay, I'm on probation, and obviously my life's unmanageable, so yes, you know, came to believe in a power greater than ourselves. You know, I never got to a place where I said, no, there's no God. I had a lot of issues with that, you know. But I could feel what you guys had. And I could see what you had. And I knew for myself that you're onto something that I don't know about, you know. And that was very intriguing, you know, it was really intriguing. And I wasn't, like I said, I was not in a place where I was like, okay, there's no God. So for me, like, the second step was just that, yeah, you know, there's something out there. You know, obviously you guys have it, and I'm interested. Not that I was, like, ready for you guys to, like, I don't know, what do you call it, just like sit down and tell me all about it or anything like that. But the third made a decision, you know. I don't know that I spent a lot of time on that step at first. It was more of, I was willing to do what you guys were doing, you know. Like, I was willing to meet with my sponsor once a week. I was willing to do what we did at those meetings, and for me, being willing to start participating and taking action in AA, that was me turning my will and my life over to God as best as I knew how. I was willing to do something different. I was done with my way didn't work. You know, that's where it always starts with me. It's not that I'm, like, ready to just grab hold of your way, but I'm convinced my way doesn't work. And that's kind of where it starts to usher me into willingness to the next thing. You know, and the whole made a searching and fearless moral inventory. You know, I talk to some newcomers, and it's like they get a lot of ideas about AA before they get into the action, and I've just kind of reflected on it, and I was like, maybe I was just not paying attention. I don't know. I was coming to meetings, but, like, when I started doing the writing and the inventory and stuff, I didn't realize, well, we're doing, I don't know. It's like I didn't absorb that this is step four, and I'm going to have to share this stuff, you know, and I'm going to have to, yeah, I just didn't have a lot of thinking. It was like I'm just, like, doing what I have to do still, I guess. I was still kind of in that mode of, you know, I want to come to meetings. I want to be around you guys. And so I did the work. And, you know, what that did for me is I really got a, for the first time, a look at myself. Like the book talks about swallowing some chunks of ourselves. And I just, at the end of doing that work, I just remember I didn't want to be like that anymore. You know, it was like, I just don't want to keep doing this. I don't want to be like this anymore. My way doesn't work, and I'm open to something else, you know. And I remember the first thing I said to my sponsor was, I sound like such a brat. Like, that's what I felt like after reading my inventory, you know. And I didn't know I was going to have to read it to her, but when I got there, I was like, I wasn't about to be like, no, you know. So I felt like I was kind of trapped. And I felt kind of tricked, you know, but in any case, I did, and then, you know, I made that fear inventory and the list of people I had harmed, and I don't know, I guess what I can say is I'm grateful I was desperate, because it was just okay, you know, I was just like, everything was, well, we're going to do this, okay, we're going to do that, okay, and I did, and I remember people saying a gift of desperation, and I didn't realize that, what a gift it was. Looking back, I realized it was such a gift, because I was just okay, all that argument, all that putting up a fight, all that stuff my parents had to deal with, it was kind of gone by the time I got here, you know, I was definitely beaten to a state of reasonableness by alcoholism. And I will say, like, for me, it wasn't, like, they talk about at step five, you know, maybe having, like, this great effect, you know, feeling this great effect, you know. I didn't really have that. I will say it was very comforting to have finally told my whole story exactly, exactly in my perspective to someone else that just really had no skin in the game, you know, that someone else knew the truth about me. And when I started doing the amends, that's when I started really gaining some sanity outside of the meetings, you know. I had a big aha moment, especially with my first amends, and that was the first time, just like when I took that drink in that car, and I didn't have all that stuff going on in my head and the fight and the argument and, like, and just felt like I could be where my feet were. I got that after I made my first amends. I remember driving home in a quiet car and just, like, not a care in the world. Just, like, really feeling like that whirlwind had stopped, that tornado, like, and I just remember thinking clearly that this is what they're talking about. Like, this is what those people are on to, you know? And just being like, wow. Like, I mean, like, I could hear everybody tell their stories and see that they were genuine about it, but I didn't know that it would work for me. Like, I was willing to do it because I wanted to be here. And something that made sense to me was, if you want to belong, you got to do what they do. Like, that kind of already made sense to me, you know? And I didn't want to feel like, for whatever reason, I didn't want to feel inauthentic with you guys. I don't know. It was like, I didn't want to feel phony in here, you know, because I wanted to be a part of it. And but when I did make the amends and I had that moment, I just remember being like, holy shit, you know? It's real, you know, like, this stuff works, you know, and it gave me a whole lot of energy to keep moving forward. Then I think it was at that point for me, and I don't know how many months into the program it was, but I remember being like, okay, I'm about this, like, you know, and you know, doing the step 10 and just continuing. For me, that was, it made sense to me. It was like I cleaned up all the stuff that I already did, and then I just kind of quit doing it, or if I make mistakes, I fix it. You know, that's basically what it meant to me, is like, you know, I make amends for my behavior, and then I change my behavior, you know, and if I don't change my behavior or I make hiccups along the way, like, I fix that right away. You know, that made sense to me. I was like, okay, I get that, you know. And the process of, like, continuing to seek God, you know, in prayer and meditation, that's been a lot different, you know. I'd like to say that, you know, my concept of God just overnight was different. I'd like to say that a lot of these steps and applying them to my everyday life was just like cake after that. What I'll say is the first time through, it was definitely life-altering. It definitely was a beginning, like the book talks about. It was a foundation. But I will say it's been a continuing thing. You know, I've had to revisit the God subject a lot, I feel like, since I've been here. I've, you know, and it's kind of come up when situations in life comes up, when experience in life comes up. It's like they say more will be revealed. And I've had a lot of different life situations where it's like, it's been a choice point, you know, where it's like, do I move forward and do I grow in AA? Do I have the courage to dive a little deeper with this whole me and God stuff? Or do I start walking the other direction, you know? And I'm grateful for my story as far as, like, the bottom that was my bottom, because there's been a lot of times in AA where it's like, if it wasn't for that, that might sound tempting, you know, going the other direction, but it's not. It's like, I've been there, I know what that is, I know what it is to live in my own personal hell every day. And for my solution, which was drinking, to just not work anymore, and to feel like there's no way out. You know, I love the stories in the back of the big book where it talks about we found a way out, you know. What a miracle. You know, I did not think there was any way out. I felt like I had buried myself, and I made my bed and I lay in it, you know. But I came here and you guys said, no, there is a way out. There is a solution. And with the different life events, it's like I always find the courage because you guys give me that courage. I don't do anything alone. And it's, I don't know, it's just there's someone in one of the memes that always said there's no lid on this thing. And I found that to be true for me. It's like sometimes it feels like it just gets mundane or routine or dull. And it's like inevitably something always happens, and I have to get busy again. You know, I have to be active, and it kind of happens for me. You know, there's been times where I felt like I could just figure this thing out, like it was a code or like a, you know, and I thought, well, I'm doing this, I'm checking the box, I'm doing this and I'm doing that, and I should be getting these results, you know, and it doesn't really work out for me when I'm doing that. And now I'm more in a place where it's like I've just accepted that, you know, life's gonna come how it's gonna come, and I put my best effort into it, but God's really the one doing it, you know. And as long as I show up and I stay willing and I stay as active as I know how to be, you know, those lessons come, and when they come, I do what's suggested. You know, I don't know. I'm grateful for y'all to be here tonight, and that's my story. And I think I'll just finish there.